K2 Romeo India Whiskey here, and we're going to begin the TechNet. Major purpose of the TechNet is education. Eventually people find out some of this very complicated hobby called ham radio. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio, maybe 27. 2-meter FM repeater work is just one of them. 2-meter simplex is another. And there's 25 more. So if you get a little bored with one, don't give up. Try some of the others. Probably no more educational hobby that you can consider when it comes to learning wireless technology. I'm slowly concluding from my occupational experience that if you really want a wireless engineer, you have to hire somebody who either is a ham radio operator or one who has 90% of the philosophy of a ham radio operator. The schools don't teach this stuff. We learn it hands-on, comparing information with each other, telling each other what we learn, and reading books on the subject. The most readable books on wireless that you'll ever find are the whole series of books by the American Radio Relay League, the Antenna Book, Antenna Manual, Radio Amateur's Handbook. You'd be amazed how many RF engineers who are not ham radio operators who have the Radio Amateur's Handbook sitting on their shelf. Some of them hide it. Somehow they don't want to admit where the information is coming from. It's a little bit sad, but in past years, people who practice this hobby, who are professionally in the electronic world, think that there's something less than honorable about it, whereas in Europe, a person with a ham radio license is almost given as much respect as a guy with a bachelor or half of a master's degree. So Mel and I, and you guys are working on that. Mel, K2KEY, and I will accept your call letters and your name at this time when you want to sign in. You're going to give us your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
This is KC2QYW. The name is Joe. At this time, no questions. Back to the net. How are you guys doing now?
K2RIW. This is W2 Tango Tango Tango. Gordon, no question, Dick, and pleasure to hear your dulcet tones in your introduction.
Okay, we had a triple that time, but so far we got Joe and Gordon, both with a no. And who are the other people we missed?
So we Rich, what do you ask?
KC2MDP, Steven, yes. And good evening, all. This is KC2KEY.
And good evening, this is WS2N. The name here is Paul.
Okay, that time we picked up Rich, Steve, Mel, and Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call with the name at this time. Okay. If things get a little bit late tonight, there's a beautiful website that I've discovered, even beyond the ARRL, amateurradio.tv. We brought that up at the tail end of the next last week, and maybe some of you guys went to sleep already, around 11:30. If you want to have an awful lot of fun, just dial in www.amateurradio, no punctuation, amateur radio. There's a double R in there. R at the end of amateur and R at the beginning of radio. Amateurradio.tv, dot Tango Victor. There's no com. There's no net. It's dot Tango Victor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. There you will find the fact that KC2NJI, Perry, has recorded every single TechNet since September of 1996, and essentially all of the TechNets since the beginning of 2000 are all recorded and displayed. You'll see that each of the TechNets, if you click on the left-hand side, you'll see an expansion of every minute, what was the subject being discussed. And you'll see reel number one, reel number two, reel number three, and those are the hours of the reels of the audio you can listen to. So you can dial the right reel, dial the right number of minutes into the reel, and listen to that particular subject. It's all cataloged. An amazing effort from my standards. It's a labor of love. So Don, many times over the years, people have asked me, gee, do you keep tape recordings of this? And the answer, of course, was no. It would take all kinds of man hours for me to record these things, make copies for people, catalog them, and so on. I'm busy enough as it is just answering the zillions of questions you guys got. And Mel and I can't keep up with it all. Mel has volunteered temporarily, that's a prediction on my part, temporarily to attempt to answer people's emails on the subject. And he's getting something like 75 or 80 emails per week. That isn't it a labor of love? I think he's going to have to slack off a little bit. If you don't get an immediate answer from Melda, be patient or be forgiving. He's being inundated. He volunteers for something. I think he may have bit off a little more than he can chew, but I'll let him discuss that when it comes around to his turn to talk as to whether or not he thinks he's a bit off more than he can chew. The second subject I want to discuss tonight is I discovered a man named William Beatty, William J. Beatty. I wasn't smart enough to write down the website, but I made copies of The Philosophy of Electrical Engineering, or engineering in general, technical studies in general, that he has on his website. And you read that material and you say, wow, somebody finally got it all together. What is a real engineer? It's a rare animal by the standards of Mel and Dick and Paul and Rich and the other guys who sign in frequently. I think inside of each ham radio operator fighting to get out is a scientist, a person who wants to do research. What is Mother Nature telling him? How does that signal propagate? How do those antennas work? Why does that signal go down that feed line that way? Why does the transmitter do that? Why does my receiver do that? It's going to take us a while to figure it out, but we're working on it. So a little later on, I'll read you some of this philosophy. But let's start off with our first questioner, who was Rich. Haven't heard from him in a long time. That's a joke. Rich is one of our favorite sign-in people. So, Mr. Tashner, please tell us, what's the latest in Whitestone, New York? N2EO, KQRIW, and the TechMan.
Good evening, KQRIW, TechMan, Weimar, N2EO. Thanks to wrapping up the project with the Ameritone amplifier, I added a couple of parasitic suppressors to the plate circuit. I bought them from Ameritone. I used them on the AL-1200, which uses a 3CX-1200 as opposed to a 3CX-1500. I didn't see any difference, but I'm going to leave them on because I got a copy of Talking About Hooks, Bill Orr's, called The West Coast Handbook, and in there, virtually all the amplifiers with 8877s and otherwise use parasitic suppressors. My question, Dick, with the second tube, I have to re-letter the meter, the plate meter, from 0 to 1 amp to 0 to 2 amps. And I want to do a neat job of it. I want to make it look as original as possible, not just stick a piece of paper in there and re-letter it. Maybe somebody using computer graphics can answer the question. I don't know if it can be done with Adobe Photoshop. My printer has a flatbed scanner. I want to take the scale out of the meter, scan it into the computer, make the changes, reprint it on a piece of heavy photographic stock, and thereby making a new meter face. The other two scales remaining the same, just changing the ampere scale from 0 to 1 to 0 to 2 amps. Or would I need a copy I saw on the internet of a cookie Corel drawer? I'm really not familiar with what to use. Do that. What I want to do is scan it in, keep the identical fonts on the meter, and just change the lettering. Back to that, N2EO.
Okay, Rich, I see what you're trying to do. So on your Ameritron amplifier, AL-1200, is the model number, and you put the second tube in. Therefore, instead of being 0 to 1 amp, you'd like the meter to read 0 to 2 amps. My first recommendation would be that you simply leave it alone and put underneath on the front panel a number, just say X2. In other words, whatever readings you read in amperes, multiply it by 2. If you read 0.9 amps, you really know it's 1.8. That's my first recommendation. Here is why. You open up that meter, and you think it's a nice, simple device. All you've got to do is open it up and put a new piece of paper in there. And without a doubt, you choose the right computer program and use the right kind of a printer, even a inkjet printer. You can get the prettiest logos, the prettiest scale, with all the numbers tilted at just the right angle, in just the right spot, with just the right arc length, just the right radius of curvature. All of that is doable. You think that's the hard part. That by far is the easy part. You open up the meter. You are doing brain surgery. Let me emphasize that. I have opened up meters on multiple occasions in my life. On half of those occasions, I got myself in trouble. When you open up that meter, you better be doing it in an environment that has surgical cleanliness. If there was a piece of steel wool in your house in the last 6 months, do not open up that meter. Inside that meter is the world's strongest magnet. Between that magnet and that moving Dawson's valve coil, Dawson's valve type of movement, between the movement of the coil and the magnet is an extremely small air gap. The slightest piece of steel wool or any other magnetic material that is in your environment, I don't care if it's 2 feet away, and if you've got that meter open for more than 10 minutes, that piece of magnetic material will jump into free space, fall into that magnetic structure, lodge itself between that coil and that magnet, and from then on, that meter will stick. You'll see the meter go up, and you'll turn off the rig, and the meter reading will stay high. Or the meter reading will move in steps until you tap on it, whatever. When you get little whiskers of magnetic material inside of that meter movement, you have nothing but grief on the way that meter runs for the rest of its life. And you think you're going to reach in there with a microscope and a magnifying glass and a set of tweezers and you're going to remove that magnetic material? Well, if you've got a perfect pair of stainless steel non-magnetic tweezers, maybe. If you have an extremely fine set of fiberglass tweezers, maybe. You stick a magnetic tool in there to try to remove the whiskers of fiberglass or whatever else that gets into that meter movement because you want to clean it up. Wow. You wouldn't believe how difficult it is. The next thing you're going to think of doing is that, okay, I'll take it apart. I'll take the actual meter movement away from the magnet. And I tried doing that once. Oh, boy, can you get into a heap of trouble when you do that. Because there is this round slug of magnetic material inside of that circular gap of the magnet, and so the real moving coil is midway between that round slug of magnetic material and the actual strong, steady magnet on the outside. And to try to keep them properly aligned while you reassemble them and screw it down and properly align it and adjust it without creating damage, wow, you better have the strength of Arnold Schwarzenegger and the manual dexterity of a brain surgeon. And I'm not kidding. And you better have some fancy tools that'll hold things in just the right spot at the right time, and those tools better be very strong, computer-generated, and so on. So my strongest recommendation is, unless you absolutely positively think you've got to, do not open up that meter. That's a recommendation. Now, let me throw it over to the net. Maybe there are people who recommend methods of you generating this beautiful dial that you want to glue in there. But my strongest recommendation is do not open up the meter unless you're backed against the wall and you've got no other choice. You're way ahead of the game, but just put a mark on the outside saying whatever you read, multiply it by 2. Let's see if we've got some people out there with some further comments on my strongly felt opinion. I've got some emotion on this one because I've ground up some awful beautiful meters in my time. K2KEY, K2RIW in the segment, we're listening.
Hey, yeah, K2KEY, I've done it many times.
Mel, Bell is one of the people that just signed in. Who's the other person?
I said amen, brother, W2TTT.
Okay, sounds like Gordon's been there. Bell, let's have your war story and horror story of opening up meters and trying to keep them in good working condition after you did it. Maybe you're one of those guys that's smart enough and you can look ahead and know what the troubles were going to be, but you open up one of those meters and you are walking across a minefield. Go ahead, Mel. Tell them.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot of surplus meters, you know, western surplus around ones. I picked up, you know, very reasonably at a number of hamsets, just salvaged off a lot of panels and all. And, of course, every one of them never more calibrated really to what I needed, very few in fact. And so what I've done, I've had success. What I do, first of all, I have a holder. I have a little wood block, a flat wood block, that with I drilled out so that the meter will sit in that wood block facing up to me, and it can't, you know, all of a sudden, you know, as you're taking, if you take off the cover, you got to be very careful with the screws and all those little things. It's very hard to replace that stuff. Now, first thing I do, and I do it usually on the kitchen table. First thing I do on the kitchen table is fix it. I got to make sure magnetically there's nothing around. And so what I do is use from an old magnetron. I have a nice, oh, good magnet, terrific magnet. I move it around the area, make sure there's no, like I say, little pieces of steel wool or anything floating around the area. Next thing I do is stick to the meter, take the screws, open the screws up, take the screws out. And you gotta be very careful when you pull up the cover of the meter. You know, don't give it twists or anything like that. Bend the centering control. You know, that little V-shaped piece in there that sets to zero. And now you flip the cover off the meter very carefully. Now to take the face off. What I do is that is where you've got to be careful. Don't bend the pin, you know. That is where your damage usually comes with. So take those screws out. Usually that holds the face on there, the face plate. And if you're very careful doing that, take the face plate out over the side, screws everything aside. You need to use the fine, the right screwdrivers, you know, little jewelers, small screwdrivers, things like tweezers and things like that. And then I put a cover over the meter. I have a plastic cover that, you know, like Tupperware. I lay that over the meter where it's sitting on the table. And now I can work on the face plate. Now, what I usually do is erase. With an eraser, I can take the numbers off very, very carefully, take the numbers off, leaving, being careful not to disturb the scale. Now, to put the new numbers on, I use what they call press type. Now, I know there's a number of ways you can do it, of course. You can copy, make a copy of it into your computer and, you know, and make up another piece of paper and then glue it on and all that kind of stuff with contacts. And then, you know, but I found that I could do very well by just erasing the original scale, you know, the numbers on the, whatever it is on the original scale, and by using press type. It takes a little dexterity, a little patience, black press type letters, numbers, and just rub them, and it'll put it right back onto the scale, and then reverse the process. I've done it for a number of meters. You'll learn, you know, at the early times and all, I have destroyed, like, also a few meters. I've got some in my graveyard. I've got a box of them. I keep them for the screws and the glasses for this, you know. But if you're very careful and all, you can do it, Dick. I could say, I'd say good success. The last one I did was a 6-inch meter. I added it to my dry dummy mode. I picked up a whole bunch of 150 watt resistance, carbon resistance, and I made one of these huge dummy loads with it. And you know, the resistance about 18 inches long and about an inch or so in diameter. And I put them all together, made a big pile, resistance pile there for a dummy. This is my dry dummy load that I have on the bench. A nice, you know, grill around it and all that stuff. And I wanted a meter. I found a nice meter for or it was caught. Calibration was wrong. It was salvaged out of a, actually out of a picture tube tester. Nice, just right meat inside, so had to change the scale around, and that was the last one I did there. K2RIW in the group, K2KEY.
Fantastic. Now, along with what Mel is saying, make sure that the person who disassembles that meter for you, Rich, make sure it's a person with very good set of eyes, a very steady hand, good manual dexterity, no tendency towards shake of the hand. So good steady hand, good sharp set of eyes, a bright light, a swept spite space where a strong magnet's been wiped over everything to make sure that there's no remaining little part. Maybe lay down a very clean piece of large white paper, not plastic, because plastic can easily create electrostatic attraction. And there's a so-called triboelectric series. Triboelectric. You look up that word on Google, and you'll get a mind blower of static electric properties. In other words, you know what an electromotive series is, where certain dissimilar metals are not supposed to be brought together, like copper and steel. Copper and aluminum is one of the worst ones. Never bring copper and aluminum in direct contact with each other, but they're going to be exposed to something like an outdoor environment. Super dry indoor environment, you might get away with it. Outdoor environment, you're going to be in trouble. So there are certain metals by the electromotive series, dissimilar metal series, that you do not put together. When it comes to insulating materials, dielectric materials, there's something called the triboelectric series. It's a very well-kept secret. Not very many people know about it. You look up that word, and you'll see a list of materials where human hair is at the bottom, which I think is the most positive, and rubber balloon is at the top. And in between, you've got your polyethylene, your polyester phthalates, your Teflon, your acrylic plastics, your plexiglass, polycarbonates. You got all kinds of materials, insulating materials, man, depending on which ones come together. And glass is one of them, by the way. You rub animal fur on glass, and you'll pick up some... You'll pick up 20,000 volts immediately. I've got a great meter question for you after we finish this one. You got me on one of my favorite subjects. So be careful. It can be done. By the way, while you're at it, even before you take it apart, it would be fun to start off with a known good Western laboratory standard current meter or a very good brand of digital voltmeter and actually put it in series with your meter and run various currents through it with a series resistor and a power supply, and make sure that your meter movement and the digital voltmeter track each other and then have reasonable accuracy throughout the range. If there's any doubt, borrow, why can't I think of his name, N2MB, borrow Barry's best digital voltmeter and make sure that they compare. But still, it would be fun to track the accuracy of his meter before you take it apart. You may find that it's a 5% high everywhere, and that'll maybe steer your standards, your technique by which you're going to shunt that meter to make it read twice the current. And the shunting technique, there's an art and science to doing that correctly, so that whatever resistor you put in parallel the meter to make it read twice as high, to make sure that it has good contacts that are not going to change. You're talking about a very small number of ohms here, and as such, depending on how you put that shunt in there, it may change in time and change the reading of the meter. So you got to be a little bit careful with what you're going to do. It's a fun project. We're not trying to discourage you, Rich. We just want to tell you what the pitfalls are, because Mel, I, and I can tell that Gordon have been down this road. We've created some dead bodies when it comes to Dawson valve movements, and we're trying to have you avoid some of the grief we've been through. We've all used some strong, salty language after we've done some pretty dumb things. We didn't know it was dumb until hindsight set in. And with all that discouragement, Rich, go ahead and have some fun. N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick,
K2EL.
Yeah, I know the dry transfer metal you're talking about. I've taken a few meters apart in my life. This one here, the plastic just pops right off it. I did have it apart, put it back together, and everything seems to be all right. I have two spoons to take the plastic face out. Like Mel said, you don't want to bend. You want to bend the point. And I screw it up. Another meter was available from Ameritron for about $18. So it's not a high-risk thing. I was hoping somebody had some ideas on using computer graphics to generate a new meat face. In other words, identical except for that one scale. If anybody has familiarity with CorelDRAW, or if I could use Adobe Photoshop to keep the same font and just change the value.
Okay, let's give a quick call for that. So, any of you computer mavens out there, Photoshop of Adobe, CorelDRAW, and there's probably five more programs. Anybody have any experience with one approach would be to scan the current meter movement tail, scan it into the computer program, leave everything as is except just change the numbers, put in the new numbers of the right font with the right tilt of each of those numbers, and maybe even put in some additional markings in between the markings are there so you can find a gradation of reading. So anyone with familiarity of computer programs that can make a meter face for Rich, give us your call letters right now.
UKY, I'll give it to them.
Go ahead, Mel. Is there anyone else before we pick up Mel? You got the floor, Mel.
Okay. It was covered in QFT within the last couple of years. It's one. In fact, lives in New York. I know him. He's a professor also in electrical engineering. Can't think of things right now. Oh, he's going to be mad at me. He did an article in QFT, and he gives all the instructions on how to use the WordPerfect. I think he used WordPerfect. How to set it up and everything. Very, very simple. How to scan it and everything like that. If you do a, go to the ARL website, Rich, and, go into that research thing they have up there, you know, researching articles, and just put in meter movements or meter calibration or, what was the article? How did he write it? Salvaging surplus meters or something like that. Something of that, but just put in meters. I think that'll come up, Rich. Maybe I could find it even while we're talking tonight there and all. If I think of it, I'll remember what QFT. Within the last maybe 2 or 3 years, Rich, over.
Okay, that's a good thing to search for. Maybe it was under, you think it was under Hints and Kinks, or was it a completely separate article from your recollection, Mel?
It's a complete article. It was a complete, regular article that covered a couple of pages. He got the photograph, taking the meter apart, all the different ways to be careful, and, the whole spiel, and how to go ahead. And he shows the face being altered in different stages. He shows the materials he bought, the contact, the type of where to get the contact glue, the right, what kind of paper to use. He goes through a whole deal. Very, very, he did a lot of research and a lot of practice, let's put it this way, because it's very elegant the way he does it. Very professional when he's finished, over.
Yeah, I'm a little bit amazed that there was so much need for analog metering, analog indicators. It turns out that from one point of view, the whole world is analog, and digital is just a digital representation of that world. Nowadays, many of the so-called meter movements on our handy talkies and other kinds of rigs are really a bar chart, a barber pole, or a digital readout. Digital readouts with a lot of training are okay, but if you're trying to tune to a minimum current on a grid meter, or maximum minimum current on a plate meter, maximum current on a grid meter, and you're trying to find the peak or find the valley with a continuous moving analog-like meter, doing that is fairly easy. With a digital display, it takes training. When digital watches first came out 20 or so years ago, let me think now, around 20, 25 years ago, I had a fair amount of trouble with a digital watch. for about a 3 or 4 month period of time, I wore two watches on my left hand, left wrist, an analog and a digital. I was so used to the fact that somebody declared a meeting at 3 o'clock. I didn't have to go through the process of reading my watch. I could just represent what I was looking for by putting my two hands together, heel to heel, with one hand straight up and one hand to the right. And that would be equal 3 o'clock. So all I knew is that the hands had to be on the watch in a certain way, and as I got close to that approach, I knew I had to go to a meeting. Whereas to really read a digital watch and say, gee, I'm 17 minutes away, takes a lot of interpretation. So when it comes to meters, some of the higher class instrumentation these days has a analog meter and a digital meter, both on the display device, because there are times when the analog is very handy when you're doing a peaking and valving operation. Now, along the subject of meters, the older guys here know about the Triplett and Simpson volt-ohm milliamp meter. Classic. There must be a million of those things in use in the United States, even today, because of their... just everybody fell in love with the darn thing. In its day, it was a piece of resistance. And the really good one would have a voltage sensitivity of 20,000 ohms per volt. In other words, you put it on the 10-volt scale, and it would represent 200,000-ohm resistance. If there was a 100-volt scale, it would be 2 mega-ohm resistance, 20,000 ohms per volt. You calculate what that means, and it means that the voltage range really has a different series resistor in series with the meter, and the meter itself is 50 microamps full scale, 20,000 ohms per volt. In other words, you put 1 volt, and by Ohm's law, you divide the voltage by current, by voltage by ohms, 20,000, and you realize that the meter movement is 50 microamps. And 50 microamps is about the most sensitive meter you can get that is reasonably rugged, reasonably reproducible. There have been more sensitive meters than that, but they're very special production runs. So 50 microamps is a good meter. I own a meter that reads 30,000 volts full scale. What's your guess as to the ohms per volt? Volts per ohm. 20,000 ohms per volt? What's the ohms per volt of my 30,000 volt meter? Anyone want to make a guess? Mel, I'm going to corner you on this one. 30,000 volt full scale meter. What's your guess as to the ohms per volt, or the number of microamps it takes for full-scale deflection? How much do you think that particular meter loads down the circuit that I connected across? And with some difficulty, I can tell you the actual brand name on the thing, American Physics or something like that, a fairly rare brand. So, Mel, want to make a guess as to how sensitive that meter movement is?
Just the one with the long resistor in it, that they use for checking. Check the high voltage on a color picture tube. Is this what you're talking about? It has the 200 meg resistor in it. Over.
Good guess. You're talking about a so-called high voltage probe. Tektronix, among other companies, probably Hewlett Packard too, made this great big Flash Gordon probe, is what we used to call it. In other words, it's got a handle on it. It's got a great big round plastic washer in front of that that looks like a hand guard for a sword. And in front of that is this great big long structure, conic structure, ending with a point at the tip. And inside is a zillion ohm resistor, so that's a very high voltage probe, a voltage divider network. Good guess? No, it does not contain one of those. Now you want to make a guess as to what the meter movement is, how much current it draws at full scale, 30,000 volts. Back to you, Mel.
The meter movement on it, not that, but based on that. What is the... I think I can picture it, yeah. It's most likely similar to what I'm thinking of. It has the long stem in front and those two sort of plastic rings so your hand can't slip up, I guess, or whatever. And the meter is built into the bottom of the handle with a brown wire coming out the bottom. Is that the one I'm thinking of? Over.
I know the one you're thinking of. No. This thing has a great big high voltage probe coming out of the back. It looks like a miniature version of the PI insulators you have on a high voltage transmission line of Con Ed. It's got a miniature version of one of those coming out the back, and it has three scales, 30,000 volts full scale, something like 10,000 volts full scale, and something like 5,000 volts full scale. Not sure of the exact voltages, but it's got three scales, and the highest scale, the highest voltage scale, is 30,000 ohms per volt. It's got the high voltage probe like-looking structure coming out the back of the machine. The front is nothing you can touch, except this great big meter movement. The meter movement must be 9 inches wide, and it's a mirror-backed meter movement where you can line your head up so that the needle is properly aligned as far as parallax is concerned with the mirror backing, and therefore you can read it very accurately. I've had a lot of fun connecting that to my Wimhurst machine and connecting it to my Van de Graaff generator, and I did another very interesting experiment with that. Maybe I'll tell you guys later. So, one more guess, Mel. The meter itself is a huge black box, approximately 11 inches square by approximately 9 inches tall. Big black box, 8 or 9 inch wide face on the meter. Three scales, as I said. And you guys are going to give me one more guess as to what is the sensitivity of the meter movement. You can give it to me in ohms per volt, microamps for full scale, and have fun with this one. KQLAW listening for any volunteers.
I know what you're talking about now. Yes, I know it. I know it very well. I think the meter movement was, 5 microamps, if I'm not mistaken, Dick, over.
Good guess. It is considerably more sensitive than that.
What in the 1 microamp here? I don't believe. I could swear it said FF 5 microamp. Or am I thinking of another one of their meters? I remember it's a mirror scale. I should say I remember that thing so well. I've looked at it so many times, Dick.
Okay. What else can I give you to lead you astray, but yet tell you the truth? I will tell you that when it's reading full scale, 30,000 ohms per volt, and I put it across my Van de Graaff generator, I run the Van de Graaff generator for a couple of seconds. My Van de Graaff generator, if it runs full speed, comes up to 200,000 volts. It will jump a spark approximately 5 inches, maybe 6 inches, between two spheres that are about 9 inches in diameter. So it'll make a 5 or 6 inch spark, and if I only run it for a few seconds, up to 30,000 volts, and I watch the meter movement, I turn off the Van de Graaff generator, and I sit there and watch the thing discharge. The discharge takes most of an hour. And you calculate what that means in ohms of loading, and you come up with a very interesting number. What I told you was the truth, and that's another clue. Back to you, Mel.
I'm the only one I remember. For some reason, it sticks in my mind that was said FF5 microamps. I remember looking at it. Gee, that's an awful sensitive meter. Maybe it was on one of their other models, but I guess, I don't remember, Dick. I only remember the probe with the thick black wire coming out of the bottom of the probe with that, like a knurled silver ring that screwed on to the bottom of a probe. Is this the gray probe, over?
That gray probe is a so-called high voltage probe. This thing does not have that. I will tell you that the amount of loading it creates is not a million ohms. It is more than a million times higher than a million ohms. Considerably higher than a teraohm of load impedance. That's another clue, Mel.
Well, the only one I know I can say, know that probe now, I remember it, that had a 2,000 megohm resistor in it. 2,000 megohm resistor, I believe that's what it was rated at, Dick, if I'm not mistaken, over.
This thing has a load impedance significantly higher than 2,000 megohms. Back to you, Mel.
I don't remember, to tell you the truth, Dick. But I know, yes, it would be way up there. I know they had, I remember the meter distinctly, but it's been some years ago. I thought that the meter movement was maybe it was 0.5. I think it may now, I remember 5. Maybe it was 0.5 microamps, Dick, over.
0.5 microamps would be 2 megohms per volt. This thing is well above 2 million megohms per volt. Well above that. Another clue.
You know, you're taxing my memory. I don't remember really. Maybe it was... I know it had a 5 in there. Could have been 05, 005. But, you know, that's all I can do. The only thing I can do is picture the 5. That's it. I remember in a corner, on the bottom on the right, in the bottom of the meter, on the big meter, it said FX. And I remember a 5 in there. That's all I can remember, over.
Okay, this meter does not have a marking on it, like 0.5 FS. No such marking. Another clue. I'm going to tell you. This meter movement, the hold-on machine, I was so fascinated with what it does that I had to take it apart and study it. And I said, wow, that's an interesting piece of engineering. The fact that I can load a few picofarad circuit at 30,000 volts and it takes hours for it to discharge, you know we're talking about many teraohms. And we're talking about 10 to the 12 ohms here. This thing is the closest thing to an open circuit you're ever going to see, Mel. The meter movement is not a Dawson-Bell movement. This is an electrostatic meter. That great big brown multi-step insulator out the back, which is the probe that goes in there, is nothing but a ball on the end of a quarter-inch diameter rod. The quarter-inch diameter rod ball comes near a piece of metal that's connected to the meter movement. The electrostatic attraction makes the meter move. You change the scale by pushing and pulling on that rod. It's got three click positions. And as you click it further and further out away from the meter movement, that's where it gets the higher and higher voltage. It's an electrostatic attraction meter. It draws zero current, because it's only working on electrostatic attraction. It's a precision laboratory equivalent of an electroscope, except it's got this precision mirrored scale meter movement to it. I can clean this thing up real good with an alcohol cloth, and as I said, I can put it on the sphere of my Van de Graaff generator, and it takes an hour to discharge it. If I put my fingerprint across the insulator, which is the input probe, it'll discharge my Van de Graaff generator twice as fast because of the impedance of my fingerprint. This thing is the closest thing you are ever going to see to a thoroughly open circuit test instrument, which almost violates Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's the only voltmeter I have ever used that creates zero loading of the circuit in a resistive manner. It creates a small amount of capacitance, but no resistive loading of the circuit you connect it on. Considerably different than the modern-day digital voltmeters are all 10 megohms input impedance, regardless of what scale you're on. It draws 10 megohms of load resistance. This thing is more than a million times higher than that because it doesn't draw a current. It measures electrostatic attraction. Ain't that an interesting piece of engineering? And this thing was probably built in 1950. And that's why it was being discarded by New York Institute of Technology. I was in the right place at the right time, digging through their dumpster, and I said, why in the world is that being thrown away? Yes, they can't use it. I can. Back to you, Mel. Have some fun with this one.
Now, I want to ask you something. The one I'm thinking of, now it's putting two and two together. they had one that they had a crank handle on the side that generated what it was for. I think it was for checking breakdown or something, that had a meter that on it, and I believe it was like 0.005 or 0.05 microamp. This is the one I'm thinking of, Dick. It had do you remember it was in a wood box? It was Tektronix made back, I think maybe back in the 40s or 50s. And it had a crank handle that folded out and you turned it. This is what I'm thinking of, Dick, over.
Yes, that's called a Hi-Pot. That puts 500 volts, 1,000 volts, 2,000 volts across your circuit and measures the current it draws, and therefore you find out whether or not your circuit has a leakage resistance. That's called a Hi-Pot. And that thing really does draw current, or measure the current that's drawn by your circuit. This thing is way beyond that. The good news is this draws essentially zero current. You keep this thing good and clean, and it draws no current, even though it can measure 5,000, 10,000, and 30,000 volts full scale. That's the good news. I'm trying to find a way, mentally, that I can put a voltage divider network on it. I don't want to read 30,000 full scale. I want to keep that. I want to read 300,000 full scale. I want to multiply it by 10. But it does not have a voltage divider resistor in there. If it did, just adding another resistor, I could easily up the voltage if I could make that kind of a resistor, which, again, is an arc form. To make a resistor that can tolerate these kind of voltages without arcing in the individual molecules of the resistor, you take a 2-watt, 10-megohm resistor, and you put anything more than 1,000 volts across it, and it's going to do some funny things. I mean, the resistance versus voltage is not going to be linear. You're going to start jumping between the individual, you're going to be arcing between the individual carbon molecules that are inside of the Allen Bradley resistor itself. And a wire-round resistor of 10 megohms is essentially out of the question. Not impossible, but it would be as big as a house, so to speak, to make one reliable. So, in my case, I don't want to draw any current, but I'd love to multiply this thing to 30,000 volts, 300,000 volts full scale instead of 30,000 volts full scale. I throw that out to you guys as a challenge. Solve that one. I'll give you a big pot of money. I'm only half kidding on this one. I'm going to stand by in case we got a couple of smart people out there who know how to do it. I haven't figured a way to do that one yet. KQRIW on the TechNet. Oh, there's a challenge for you guys. All right. The next person to be signed in, we better go before, let's see now, who was that? Steve, hope we haven't put you to sleep with this one, Steve. KC2, Mike Delta Papa, what's going on in your neighborhood? KQRIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on the net. KC2MVP, thanks, Steve. Follow-up question to a discussion I guess we had about a month and a half ago, Dick. I don't know if you remember, I had that TQ Systems amp for 6 meters. And basically it was way low output, you know, output wattage. The SWR was like 4 to 1, you know, from the rig to the amp itself. I don't know if you remember that. Well, I finally got the thing fixed. It's on its way back. It should be here sometime this week. And I asked the guy, you know, what the problem was with it. And he told me it was an output filter. Now, I would imagine an output filter is basically just like a bandpass filter, and is this possible that this would happen, you know, that I, you know, that we see these kind of characteristics, you know, with high SWR, put 16 watts into it, you get like 5 watts out of it, and meanwhile the amp is still drawing its specified, you know, 43 to 50 amps, actually, yeah.
Okay, when it comes to frequencies like 10 meters and above for sure. By the time you get to 6 meters, you're heavy into it. I've seen it really heavy on 432. If anything is wrong with the Pi plate tank circuit, Pi L plate tank circuit, half-wave resonator, quarter-wave resonator, whatever it is, if anything's wrong with the plate tank circuit, because the tube itself is providing a capacitance that is so significant at that frequency, and I shouldn't say capacitive reactive, the tube has some reasonable number of picofarads. And if you're using it at 80 meters, no sweat. The capacitance is going to be strictly due to your C1 and your C2 of your Pi network. but by the time you get to the VHF, UHF frequencies, the same number of picofarads, 1 over 2 pi FC, becomes a smaller and smaller capacitive reactant. So all of a sudden, the stored energy in the capacitor at the operating frequency becomes significant. As such, your usual design criteria, which is on 80 through 20 meters, will say you intentionally design the circuit for a Q of 10. That allows you to choose the size of C1 and the size of the L in microhenries, nanohenries, and the size of C1 in picofarads. You know, once you've decided you want a Q of 10, which is a very good design criteria, you choose those capacitors, and off the thing goes. You plug it into the formulas that are in the radio abstract handbook in the first couple of chapters, and it'll fly like a charm. You get up to the VHF, UHF frequencies, and you cannot achieve Q of 10 anymore. The capacitance in the tube is so high that it becomes an entirely different circuit. All of a sudden, your Q is 20, 30, 40, 100, whatever. As such, the plate tank circuit is very narrow band. Hit resonance, and it works like a charm. If the plate tank circuit, for any reason on a VHF frequency, does not hit resonance, instead of putting out 700 watts, you'll put out 7 watts. It'll draw full current and beyond. You'll drive the living daylights out of it. You've got all the voltages on it. The tube is hot as all hell. It's cranking like crazy. And there's no power output. And you say, what in the world is going on? Well, if you plotted the resonance curve of response versus frequency, what you'll usually find is if, for instance, it's a 6-meter circuit and you're trying to line it up for 50.125 megacycles, the calling frequency, which I think is the calling frequency, and it's actually tuned to 49.9 megacycles, not 50.125. It's down at 49.9. And it's got a beautiful curve, but by the time you sweep it up to 50.125, you'll discover that its response is 20 dB down because of the sharp resonance curve, because of the significant capacitive reactance, significantly small capacitive reactance of that plate circuit. So it must hit resonance. And the way you can tell is that as you operate your controls on the front panel of that amplifier, you'll see that what little power you get peaks in one direction. It's either the maximum clockwise or the maximum counterclockwise on your variable capacitors of the Pi network. And that's the strong...